This edition of the Mountain Bike Podcast presented by GMBN comes as the world is still in lockdown. As of now, all mountain bike racing is on hold. So it's actually not a bad chance to catch up with some of the racers as they are in limbo. Not sure whether they're still supposed to be training to get ready for the season or just staying in their houses like most people are supposed to, and sort of hanging fire to see when the racing season will kick off again. So I took the chance to reach out to Greg Minnar over in South Africa. Greg is a downhill racing legend. He's the three-time world champion. He's got 21 World Cup victories, 77 World Cup podiums, and 10 World Champs medals. He really is the greatest of all time, the GOAT. So over to South Africa with Greg. There is a little bit of a delay on the phone lines. Hopefully that doesn't mess with your listening too much, but here we go. Okay, Greg, what's going on in South Africa at the moment?
Hey, Neil, it's pretty locked down. We've been locked in since Thursday night, but not Thursday. My government decided to take quite a strong stance on this COVID-19. It's we unfortunately have quite a large population of people that have either compromised immune systems or you know, and a lot of poverty where there's not running water and great sanitization. So I think they just felt that they needed to shut things down early before this thing spread into areas where they couldn't control it.
Yeah, it's crazy. How does it feel as a racer? Obviously, you know, last weekend was supposed to be the first World Cup of the year. You know, that was cancelled. It looks like racing may not be happening for quite a while. I saw you having a bit of banter with Bruni on Instagram the other day, but it must feel weird that you've spent your time training and getting ready for the season and now you don't really know what's happening.
Yeah, it is really hard. I mean, initially it was just Portugal and everyone thought, well, you know, maybe we'll by round two or three, once we get to Croatia and Slovenia, things will be okay. And that didn't quite happen. And then you kind of resetting the goalposts. So, okay, Fort William's going to be round one, so let's just prepare for that. And that didn't, obviously, unfortunately, that's not happening. So we haven't heard anything on Andorra. I'm hoping that will be round one. In the season, we did have a big break after Andorra. So I'm hoping that big break, that Olympics was supposed to take place in that period, we can maybe kick the season off. It's probably going to be a shortened season because Croatia and Fort William have totally cancelled. The rest have all been postponed. So it is hard. It's hard knowing that, not knowing what you're training for. You're just training to train and to try and keep on top of it. Had to take a little dig out of Bruni. I mean, it's... you know, as soon as everyone started shutting down, every sponsor and every media house were contacting all the riders. Can you film yourself training at home? It's been the latest thing and the biggest craze of COVID-19. And so we thought we'd just make a little fun of it.
Oh, nice. Right, let's take it back in the midst of time to when you started riding mountain bikes. And I mean, for most people, it's probably the year 2000 where you sort of burst onto the international mountain bike scene. And actually, you rode for a British team at that time, the Animal Orange team. And I remember you came and stayed in the UK. How did that become? And where did you start mountain biking? And how did you find yourself in England riding for Animal Orange?
While we're doing this podcast, I mean, you can see the video and behind me is this forest, and that's the exact forest I started riding mountain bikes in. We were fortunate enough to then race world champs in that same forest in 2013. That's how close it was to home. But you know, I'd raced a season in 99 as a junior. I had a pretty good year. I ended up 8th in Big Bear, California, at the World Cup in Big Bear. And didn't have such a great junior worlds. You know, world champs as a junior, you're always gunning for a top three. You're most likely going to be scouted out to possibly make it onto a team. And I think any parent would love their child to make it onto a team to save their pocket a bit of damage. So that was definitely my goal. My parents had funded me, and and actually they'd remortgaged their house to let me go and race in Europe and go travel to the US and do some racing there as well. So it's quite a big risk, and at the end of it, it paid off, and I managed to make it onto that stepping stone with Team Animal Orange.
Yeah, right. Who won that Junior World Champs then in, was that 2000?
Nathan Rennie won it. It was Aura in Sweden, and yeah, he cleaned up.
Yeah, I was there. I had a terrible time. It rained solidly for a week, didn't it? Yeah, I think I was 14th or something terrible.
I mean, those were the days that in 99, that whole season, it was wet. I'm pretty sure it was 98, it was quite a muddy World Cup season. I'd gone over and raced a few times and didn't even qualify the World Cups. And then going into 99, a bit of sunshine in Maribor, kicked off the season, managed to qualify, built up enough points to then get over to US where it's dry and dusty. So that kind of made a big difference. But then going back to the end of that season was quite wet. And you take an African rider who's grown up racing in the dust here and go put them in the European slopes with mud and rock and root, which we've never ridden on, it's pretty tricky. So that end of the season, going into the spring when there's a bit more rain and the world champs in Åre in Sweden, where it was just wet all week, there was no chance I was going to make it down.
Yeah, it was gnarly. I remember, Rennie won by like 12 seconds, I think. It was Dave Wardell was second. Yeah, I can't remember.
Dave Wardell was second, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it not day. Joel Panazzo? Oh, no. Joel Panazzo. Who was the other? Well, Rando. Was it Rando in third?
Oh, could well
Jared Rando.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, moving on another year, 2001, you took the World Cup overall off Nico. How did that feel at the time? I remember being there again for that one, Mont-Saint-Anne. Did you think that you could do that?
Yeah, so Mont-Saint-Anne was well, I had a chance and I was going to go for it. I mean, I was 19 years old. I had nothing to lose. I had won one World Cup that year and I'd just been pretty consistent, move up into second overall. I was 28 points behind Nico. And that was the first race that my parents came and watched. And I just thought, if I might as well give it a shot. I mean, who knows what the odds are? I'm not a mathematician, can work them out. But anyway, it's going to be tougher for him to hold that position than for me to try and take it off him. So I felt like I was in an easier position. And so in the qualifying, I managed to beat Nico and I pulled in 10 points from him. So it was 18 points going into the final. And that particular year in Mont-Saint-Anne, they had this big rock in the middle of the bottom forest. And you kind of came around this.
I remember, it was
gnarly. Yeah, you came
around
this
off-camber.
Well, to get onto the rock, yeah, it was really off-camber. But you had this like right-hand corner before, and then you had to like cross the tree line. So quite a narrow switchback. Then you had this right-hander around this massive rock. And I'd given it a go where you kind of skim the tree on the left, just scrape your bars a bit, and I mean, then your bars were so narrow anyway, and kind of went across the main line in these routes and then just passed really tight to the tree on your right and managed to get up onto this rock, and then, you really trickling off it and then dropped down off. But once you dropped off, you carried so much speed out of that forest. So I knew Nico hadn't done it. I was the only one who had done it that year. And I think that's what it was that gave me that edge in the final. Chris Kovarik won the race, but I managed to beat Nico, and that was enough to win the overall.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember that line really well. It was gnarly. I didn't go anywhere near it. I don't know if it was that year or not, but I'm pretty sure Steve Peat fell off it and landed on his hip and got a really gnarly bruise.
I think the following year it was a lot of guys got onto it, and I think I might have crashed a couple of years later just off that same rock. So
it's gnarly. What's your favorite track that you've raced on the World Cup circuit?
I do enjoy the speed of Mont-Saint-Anne. It's great. Another track that I just find's got a whole lot of different varieties of speed and not necessarily terrain but different different flow to the parts of trail is Andorra. It's super fast up top, and it's incredibly fast. I mean, before you get down to that midsection where the first split is, there's only like one or two sections where you're braking. The rest is absolutely pinned. Then the flow switches into these berms and you carry some speed into the bottom section, which is just incredibly steep and on the brakes. So there's a few different aspects to that track, which I really enjoy. It's I find that to me is one of the tracks I look forward to going back to.
Yeah, it's cool. It's been on the circuit since World Cup mountain biking started, but I still think it doesn't, you know, it's not an old school track really, because it's so gnarly fast, and it's, for me, what downhill mountain biking is all about. So teams wise, you rode for the Global Racing Team, which was big back in the day. You had a pretty wide range of riders in that team. Mick Hanna, I can't remember who else, Missy Giove, lots of people. And then you went on to ride for Haro. So that's when you won your first World Championships in Lugano. But I guess that was that a badged up bike, or was that an Intense badged up as a Haro?
Yeah, I think Intense had made the bike for Haro, but it was very similar to the M1, I would say.
So that was a big year for you, winning your first World Championship. And that you know, put you in place to then ride for Honda, which I think most people who've been around mountain biking for a long time are pretty curious about that whole setup, the bike, the team. Obviously, you know, I'm not a motocross background, but I'm a big motocross fan, and to see HRC in the mountain bike pits was pretty intriguing. What was the bike like to ride?
Yeah, the Honda program was interesting, and that was what was so inviting to join the team. The bike was really nothing great to ride originally, and we went testing down in Southern California at the Grace test track in Laguna Beach, and I just said to the guys, if we're going to ride this bike, we've got some work to do. And I think that's where I got into really enjoying developing product and getting behind the scenes of equipment. And you know, we had a lot of work to do on that bike, and I think once we had brought it out to race, it was race ready. It did have some issues with it. You know, it ran two chains, so you got one chain internally in the gearbox, and then you ran an external chain that drove the bike, and so the drag was quite significant on the bike. And we worked on so many ways to try and reduce the drag. So every time you went pedaling and coasting, it's not like a regular freewheel where the bike kind of maintains the speed. This was, you'd noticeably lose some speed. So that was quite tricky. But from handling to suspension and everything else on the bike, it was an incredible experience.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And there was definitely a bit of a sort of mystique around the team at the time, because it was so secretive. Like, the, you know, the gearboxes were taken out of the frames at night. You really didn't get to see what was going on. And I remember you running like the
And especially
the
that first season. You know, the first season we raced, you know, the Honda hadn't patented the gearbox. They didn't know if it could work or if it would work. So they wanted to just leave things open, but kind of keep it all behind the scenes, not let anyone see what was inside the gearbox until that the patents had come through and then it could be released. But it definitely created some rumors and a whole lot of talking points in all the forums, and I think it disappointed a lot of people when they actually saw what it was.
A mech in a box. I remember Brendan Fairclough, he left his bike on the floor once at the Athens house, and I was like, I've got to just have a sit on this thing and have a pedal around, because you weren't allowed anywhere near it. And I remember thinking, it's still cool. Like, you know, whatever you say about the drag and whatever, it's pretty cool to be able to have, you know, such a one-off bike made by such a large manufacturer and to see them in mountain biking. So it's a pretty special time.
It definitely was. I think it was, I think everyone was disappointed to see them leave the industry as well. I think they'd come in with such a bang and created a bike that still now, when you look at it, still looks futuristic. It hasn't dated. It still looks a little ahead of its time.
Yeah, at the time, and this was obviously quite a long time ago now, I wondered if they were getting ready for e-bikes. I was convinced that they could take that gearbox out and stick a motor in there, and that's an e-bike ready to roll.
It's not a bad idea.
Right, I have got some GMBN viewers questions. First one is coming from Owen, who says, if you weren't a mountain biker, what would you be doing?
Well, I'm not too sure. At school, I was all aiming for to become an architect. That's possibly the only thing I had the slightest interest in. And I don't think I would have gone that way. I don't really know what I would have done. I was so young when I made the decision to race mountain bikes and to take this up as my career. I was 16 when I had made this decision and decided to leave school and head that way, that I hadn't really thought of anything else. In hindsight, they're probably a little risky, but I didn't think of that. So I don't know. My parents had bought the bike shop, and that's what it got us into racing bikes. So I would probably have ended up taking over the shop from my parents like I have. That probably would have still happened, and I would still somewhat be in the bike industry somehow.
Cool. One from Lewis, who says, what is your biggest crash?
I've had a few big ones. I try to think about them often. The first one that comes to mind was testing, when was it? Was it last season? The year before? 2 seasons ago. It was a week before the World Cup in Lozenge in Croatia, and we're riding in the test track in San Romolo. And right up the top section, it gets quite fast and it comes down to some braking, and you do like a slight left with some rocks and stumps and down a few drops, and there's a few trees on your right hand side. And I came around this corner and I'm not sure what happened, or something hooked the pedal, but I just got ejected off this bike. And there's kind of like two drops, and I got flung in the air and went into the trees on the right, and I bounced off this tree with my hip and landed back down on the second drop on my other hip on a rock, and then just cartwheeled down the rest of the track. And I just got up and I was just like, what the hell just happened? And I'm like battling to breathe, I'm winded, and I'm trying to like move my arms and legs and fingers and toes and check that everything's still 10-10. And I like drag my bike together, and I'm trying to ride down San Romolo. It's so rough and rocky, and this is right near the top, and I'm just hurting. So I try to get to the side of the track, and I think I found this little path, and I'm trying to take this path down. I'm like limping down this path, and it just comes to a dead end. So I've got to hike all the way back up, and eventually have to just ride the trail down. But man, that was a big one, and I don't think I got really hurt. I was just banged up a bit, but that was one. Yeah, that's one I remember.
Yeah, it's gnarly. I'll track that. I used to go and test there as well with Fox pre-season. It's pretty gnarly and rough. Okay, one from Jay Kenvey. What is your handicap? Now, I presume he's talking about golf here.
Talking golf. You know, I try to play golf, and it's such a funny game because it's so strict, and everyone, all these rules, and what you have to wear, and you know, I don't play a lot of 18 holes of golf, so I don't play enough to get a handicap. So whenever I try and play, they won't let me really enter the competition because I really only play like the Wednesday afternoon comp. Yeah, I've got a golf course just up the road here. So, and I said to the guys, well, this is ridiculous. How do you expect me to get a handicap when the only time I play golf is possibly on a Wednesday afternoon in this comp, and I maybe only play about 4 or 5 of these a year? How can I get a handicap if you won't accept this as a scorecard, you know? Like, so I just play for 18, and that seems roughly fair.
Daniel says, how often do you actually get to ride Cascades? I presume that's the mountain you're talking about behind you. And what is your favourite place to ride in KZN?
So, yeah, Cascades is... I get to ride there a fair bit. I do most of my training in the forest. When I do ride down, I ride at Cascades as well. It's pretty convenient. It's always hard fitting in downhill shuttle days. You know, it's a long day. So when I do ride downhill, I try and slipstream it as much as possible. And I do ride local. We don't have too many tracks, to be honest. There's not a lot of downhill tracks around anyway around here. So Cascades is probably the best of the best choice we've got. So I do go in there a fair bit.
What type of bike do you ride the most? Are you mostly riding a downhill bike or a trail bike or a cross-country bike?
Trail bike. I don't have a cross-country bike anymore. You know, in our summer when I'm training, so like through December, January, it's quite tropical around here. So it's in summer, super hot days, you know, well into the 30s, maybe break into the 40s, and then thunderstorm in the afternoon or evening rain. And then it's humid and hot again the next day. But the problem is it's all clay-based trails. So I battle to ride mountain biking in these forests and in the rain. It's just horrendous. You get nowhere. So through December, Jan, a little bit into Feb, it's a lot of road bike and go out on gravel roads. And that's the only way I can get consistent riding. And I ride a lot of, I try and fit in a lot of trail bike riding. It's a bit tough though. You'll ride for 20 Ks and you climb probably 1,000 meters of climbing those 20 Ks and you've got 2.5 hours of riding. So it's, you know, the climbing trails are pretty tough, but it's a good place to trail ride.
Right, so let's go back to the history lessons. After the World Champs win in Lugano, so that was 2003, 2004 Leger World Champs, you were second to Fabian. How did that feel? I know Fabian went down super early in the day.
Yeah. You know, it was also a time period where, you know, the Norba was really strong. And so this was my first year on Honda. I just came off the year on Haro, and those two seasons we had to focus on the American National Championships. So where they collided with World Cups, we had to go race in America instead. So I wasn't fully racing those two seasons. So it made it a bit odd when going back to Europe, but that World Champs in 2004, it's the same famous year where PD crashed towards the end. And it was just such a crap race. You know, I think I was 0.46 behind Fabian, and I was geared up. I was ready. I was keen to win another world championship, and as I pedaled out the start gate, my knee hit the shifter. So on the Honda, we ran a seven speed bike. So the shifter was like a really cheap Shimano shifter that probably shouldn't be raced, and then was modified to fit with this Honda kind of lever. And my knee hit the shifter, bent the shifter up, and it got hooked between the other trigger shifter and the bar, which put me in the hardest gear. Now, in today's terms, it wouldn't really matter because most of the trails, you only pedal out the gate and you could possibly coast the rest of the trail and still be competitive like we've seen. But back then, you still had a lot of pedaling to do. So I was stuck in the hardest gear on the way down from the start, and had a pretty good race, but to end up 0.46 behind Fabian, I was pretty gutted with that. The only thing that made me feel even worse or possibly better that I didn't win it was that PD was about to win it. And that distracted me because I was so stoked that he was going to do it, and then he didn't.
Yeah, it's gnarly. I remember being stood next to Adele when that all happened, and it was just like the shock of it happening as it did on that, you know, virtually the last corner was pretty crazy. There's a lot of British fans there as well that were desperate for Petey to win, as a lot of racers were as well, but yeah, it didn't quite turn out that day.
Nope.
So on to, well, a couple of years further down the line, Rotorua, again, second to Sam Hill. And Canberra, again, second to Petey when he finally managed to do it. I guess, you know, Petey is the man who's had more second places at World Champs than anyone, but it must be... How does it feel? I know it's got to be frustrating, it's got to be annoying, but...
I don't know. How many seconds has he had?
I don't know. Definitely three, I think. But yeah, I need to check that on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I've had a fair few as well. I don't even know. I don't even know how many I've got.
But does it haunt you?
We've definitely got a load of silver between us.
Do you still think about it? I guess you've won it three times now. You don't have to worry so much about those second places.
They do. They are irritating. There are a few where, you know, they were so close. For sure, Leger was one of them. I think losing to Petey in Rotorua, I was pretty good about that. I mean, that too was super tight. There were a couple others that were close as well. Those do piss me off. It's when you're so close and you just haven't, you know, it's yeah. But like you say, and that does ease the mind. I did win three, and I was fortunate enough to race here at home and then win at home. And I think that topples any other race. And if that never have happened, I think I would be a little more bitter about world championships.
Yeah, sure. That's got to be, you know, if the world champs is in your town and you win it, I guess that's career done.
It is, yeah. It is.
So what about the people? You know, you've seen a lot of talented people come and go. You've had a decent, you know, length career, shall we say. So there's been people like PT, people like Sam Hill, Aaron Gwynn. Who do you think is the best person you've seen ride a bike, other than yourself?
You know, there's such a difference between riding a bike and racing a bike. I mean, if I talk about talented guys, Nathan Rennie was arguably the best guy I've seen take a flat corner. I mean, he's unbelievable to watch. I remember watching Ben Reed in Mont St. Anne, and I still can remember him in the top woods in all these little switchback corners just taking such a gnarly line and getting on top of these roots and just blasting through a section. He's an incredible rider. You've got Brendan Faircloth as well, who's just got amazing skill. You've Sam Hill. There's a few, you know. Some of them might not be guys that have won races or been challenging up the top, but they're just incredibly skilled on a bike.
Yeah, I totally agree. And Nathan Rennie, for me, I remember seeing him a long time ago. It was one of the French rounds, I think. So Vars, I think, was a place. I remember seeing him. I was on the balcony watching him on the concrete, carving turns left to right on the concrete. And he would have been pretty young, 18, 19. I was thinking, how does he even do that? That's incredible. And I think, you know, you've obviously had some pretty strong characters on the Syndicate team. And he looks like someone, well, I've hung around with him a little bit. I know he's a fun guy, but it's not someone that maybe I'd want to share a room with.
Yeah, sometimes we just ended up sharing rooms. He's a good dude. We had a good time on the Syndicate with him. But yeah, just to bring back some more guys, I mean, nowadays you've got like Hugo Frickson. I mean, and... you know, I just find his style just incredibly good, and watching him is just amazing. There's someone else I was thinking of. I remember being in Capron, Leogang, and it was back when there was the Da Vinci team with Stevie Smith, and I just remember this kid come blasting past, and it was quite tough because he came off the motorway and was really off camber to a left-hand corner, so you're fighting the camber to try to get as far right as possible to take this left-hander. And I was struggling, so I'd stopped on the trail, and this kid came blasting down and just rode up over all these roots, rocks, up to the right-hand side of the trail, blasted through this left. And he had Lucas on the back of his shirt. And, you know, I knew there was another kid on Da Vinci, and I thought his name was Lucas. And I was so confused who this rider was, but it ended up being Dean Lucas. And I remember him as a junior was really skilled.
That's cool. It's good to hear the old stories. Obviously, now the Santa Cruz Syndicate looks slightly different to the olden days. It's a bit more professional, should I say. You got, you know, two fast youths on there. You got Luke Shaw and Loris Vergier. Does it feel different to the old school days of, you know, PT and Bryceland and Rennie all hanging around in a tent?
Oh, it definitely does feel a lot different. I don't think it's comparable to that era we had before of the Syndicate. And I don't think it necessarily should be replicated or can be replicated. It just is what it is now. It's a different era of racing, and it's a different era of riders coming through.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've had Marshy in your corner for quite a long time now. Is that a special relationship that you have to have with your mechanic to, you know, travel for the year and really sort of have a good relationship?
Marshy's a very special relationship.
But it must be difficult to work with someone so closely.
Well, you know, within the syndicate and how it always ran when I came on, you know, I worked with Mike Finzale, who's now at Rorschach. But I worked with Mike for a long time. And, you know, I wanted Mike to join me on syndicate, but I didn't really have the opportunity to bring him on. And so the syndicate was managed through them supplying your mechanic. And I guess the reasoning behind that is they need to make sure that this personality fits in with all. And that's very understandable. And so that's what happened. When Marshy came along, I didn't really know him. It wasn't my choice of mechanic. This was the syndicate's choice of mechanic. And it's how you manage that relationship. We've ended up being really good friends and we've had some good times along the way. And some bad, but mainly good. So, you know, it's a different part of the sport. I think when you're within a team and you've got your best buddy mechanic in with you, it could be quite a distraction, not only in the team, but to yourself. I think within the team, it kind of separates things. And although we're not a team sport, I think the environment needs to be kind of team-based. So I think it's really good reasoning syndicate have to supply mechanics rather than riders having their best buddy come along. But yeah, like I said, with Marshy, it's, you know, we've had some good times.
So how do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy trying to develop bikes? As for racing, but also do you enjoy selling those bikes, you know, trying to improve the Santa Cruz VTEM so that people can buy it?
I do like the behind the scenes. I love testing and trying to explain what you're feeling on a bike to an engineer is pretty tough, especially for someone like myself who's possibly not the most expressive person around. And it's, you know, there is a feeling and it's a really light feeling riding a bike and what you feel and how and this feeling you and sensation you're trying to get out of the bike. And that does relate into making better bikes. You know, if I can get the V10 to handle slightly better, someone else riding a V10 is probably going to have a little bit more confidence in the bike. And then those theories and things we've tried and tested through all the testing process can easily be pushed down onto other bikes through the range as well. So it's not necessarily only downhill bikes. You want a trail bike to handle well and for the consumer to feel confident on the bike. So all these things get passed through all the various ranges of bikes.
Have you ever felt like you've had a race bike? So throughout the years, have you ever felt like your race bike was the best bike to be on that year, like it was a step above anything else that anyone else was riding? You know, do you have one bike or your favorite bike you think that was great for the time?
I think that's, you know, I've had moments where I felt really good on a bike and the setup felt great. I think it's also dangerous ground to start going onto a bike because you're leaving all your confidence in that era and in that time. I think when you're trying to replicate something from the past, that doesn't really work out. We've changed so much technology over the times. We've gone from, you know, aluminium to carbon fiber. Everything's progressed, and you want to try and take everything backwards to get the same feeling as a certain bike. So I think that's been one of the things that's kept me in the game a bit, that I've been trying to adjust my riding to fit the technologies and the new ways of setup within the industry. You know, we've gone from bikes that have really slow rebound to bikes that have really stiff suspension, really, really hard and just really fast rebound. I still potentially have mine slightly slow because I just battled to ride a bike with such fast rebound. But that's what rides faster. So it's hard to, you know, I think it's really important to keep moving forward regardless of what you felt. I think it's important you focus on what you're feeling now and try and make that feeling and sensation the best you've got.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I'm long since retired, so the way I remember a downhill bike, it's a very slow rear end, and that's just how you ride it. But it's something I think about. Like, we started racing very similar time, actually. And like I said, I'm long since retired, but I wonder how someone like yourself still finds the motivation every single off season to do the work to show up, because it's been 20 years of racing at the highest level. How do you find that motivation?
I think I'm pretty lucky. Coming back to Pietermaritzburg in South Africa, we're completely out of the scene. No one cares about downhill. No one cares about gravity. Unless you're riding the Cape Epic, no one gives a shit. Which is amazing, because I get totally out of the scene. No one talks downhill bikes. No one talks racing. Towards the end of the season, you are a little tired of talking downhill, talking gravity, and going, you know, and that gets a bit much. So I think that's what's refreshed me every season, is when I get back into racing, I'm so excited to ride good trails, to use chairlifts, to ride big mountains. I mean, this hill behind us is nothing special. So when I get to Europe and the trails are really good, I get excited to race. Our season is quite compact. So in those, 4 months of racing, it's all fresh for me. And I absolutely love it. And when I get, you know, come November, I'm back in South Africa, it's a total break from the gravity industry.
Yeah, right. That's a good way of looking at it, I suppose. Definitely seems to help. So obviously you've got a pretty incredible World Cup record, 21 wins. But what I think is really interesting is you've got a record of a podium at 60% of the World Cups that you've entered. And if you just looked at that record on paper, it would seem that that is easy for you. Do you find it easy to race and do well?
No, I don't. I do find it more and more challenging, and I think that's another reason what's kept me in the game. It's not easy getting a podium, but it's definitely not easy winning these races. I think if it was a lot easier winning it, I think you'd also get tired of that too. The challenge of staying on top, fighting yourself mentally in each race, you know, you so easily psyched out. So to keep your head in the game, to keep confidence and you know, build confidence while the track builds up. You know, you get to that first day and it's everyone sliding everywhere, but come qualifying, there's a line dug in and you're just nailing through sections. So it's holding your head as well through the weekend that's so challenging. But I think there's so many different challenges to doing well at a race that I quite enjoy that challenge of. And that's probably what's kept me going as well.
And obviously you've got that record of 21 wins, more than anyone else. Do you still have ambitions? Do you still set a goal pre-season?
I do set a goal, and I do set goals, but it was definitely not to win 21 World Cups or 22. It wasn't set out to win 3 World Championships or 60% podium 60% of the times. I've never really thought about it like that, and I just my goals are to be as prepared as I can for the season. I want to win races, and come towards the end of the season, like we finished up now in last season, you know, I was straight back in Santa Cruz with the engineers, looking at what we can do to the bike to kind of change things and alter them. And that's also, you know, if I was content with the season and with, you know, my training and where I am with the bike, that's probably also a good time to retire as well. But I've still got that fire to keep pushing forward, to find and squeeze a little bit more out of the bike here and there, to also adjust my training. I found I had a lot of weaknesses last year. I was pretty pissed off with my season. It's been a long time I haven't qualified for a race. For sure, there was a bit of weather circumstances that didn't work in my favor, but to me, that was no excuse. And I just felt like I didn't really have a great season. It had some moments where I had, you know, two good races, and the rest to me was pretty average. So If I was happy with that season too and going, oh, what a great season, so stoked, everything's amazing, yeah, sure, pull the plug. But it hasn't been that. So I'm still focused and ready to go for 2020 when we finally come around to kicking it off.
Yeah, nice. Downhill racing is super intense when it comes to the finals, especially at something like World Champs, where you've got one run, you can't mess it up. In fact, you know, you can't mess up a corner. How would you describe that to someone who's never experienced racing downhills at the highest level?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to a gymnastics routine, you know. Not that I watch a lot of gymnastics, but when the Olympics is on, you always watch those girls do their little routine on, I don't know what it's called, what part of gymnastics it is when they're on the floor doing the little somersaults and everything all around. But, you know, they've planned every part of that routine and they've got to try and nail each section or part of the routine. And that's kind of downhill racing. You know, you've planned to carry speed out of these certain corners. You've planned to break in certain areas. You've planned to hit the rock section on the right-hand side. You know, squeeze between the little gap and that's like a meter into the rocks, and then you're going to jump over the fourth rock and then blast through the rest, and you're going to pedal here. And you've got to nail this routine in that race run. And that's, to me, is one of the hardest things to do, because you can't necessarily plan for the curveball that's coming, but there will be one or two along the way, and you've got to ride it out and then try to get back into routine as soon as you can.
Is anything ever really embarrassing happened at a race? I know I've done it plenty of times. My example is Fort William World Champs. I almost got kicked over the bars on the Tissot jump. So coming into the arena in front of all the home fans, and I just look absolutely stupid. Have you ever done anything like that?
Oh, I've done a few. In fact, it happens all the time. It happens every day. I do something dumb. when you're explaining your run, going over the bars, I remember Fort William 2 years ago. It actually wasn't on camera, which I was so stoked about, because I was so buggered coming out. There's like a section of track before you get onto the motorway down the bottom, and it's just this like boring bit of track, and it's got this, you like drop around this left hand corner, you cross a little grated bridge, you go around, it's got this horrible little jump, it's been there for years, and you kind of pedal out onto the motorway. And I was sitting down, I was so knackered, and this bloody thing kicked me, and I just rode the bars all the way out into the open. So that was pretty bad, but no one saw that, so that was just my embarrassment. I crashed in the finish line in West Virginia, you know, that tightened up the finish area, but didn't really tell anyone. So I was running down the right-hand side of the track, thinking this is the closest or the shortest distance from the last corner to the finish line. And you cross the line, and everyone's now crossing on the left, and all the dirt's been pushed across, and I tried to get on the brakes and just lost the front end and went to barriers. So yeah, that was pretty bad. I was too hurt to be embarrassed, but looking back, it was pretty embarrassing.
Oh dear. Right, so what is next for you? Are you going to start racing enduro, racing e-bikes, anything like that?
Yeah. I'd love an e-bike. I mean, that Santa Cruz Hecla looks a lot of fun. That would be perfect in a place like this, where we've got this hill with not very easy up trails. I'd blast out runs all day, but I don't know. It's I'm still racing downhill. I've got a couple more years when we finally get round to it. I'm really looking forward to the season. It's I don't know what's next. I don't know if it's enduro, and I don't think it is. E-bike enduro sounds interesting though. That'll be a lot more fun. I think retirement's supposed to be fun. I don't think you retire to go and race EWS. I think that's there's better things in life. But I think that I will always be riding my bike, but I couldn't tell you. I mean, you know, who knows, EWS might get a little easier, and that I'd definitely sign up. But I don't know, if I quit racing downhill, I probably will stop racing altogether and just, you know, do something more fun. I've been competing for, I started BMX when I was 4.5 or whatever it was. So I've been competing for a long time.
Yep, super long time. Right, thanks, Greg. Thanks for chat. And yeah, looking forward to the 2020 season starting, and we'll see you there.
Cool, Donny. Thanks for having me. Thanks a lot.
Well, there you go. Thanks very much to Greg for being involved with the podcast. I thought it was really interesting. Obviously, I've been around the downhill world for a long time, so some of those old stories are really entertaining for me. And if you weren't around or into mountain biking in the early 2000s and you don't know anything about that Honda downhill bike, then definitely look it up. Get yourself on Google. It's pretty incredible to see Honda, you know, the car and motorcycle manufacturing giant, get involved with downhill for, you know, quite a brief time. I think it's probably only 3 or 4 years, I would say. Great. I also got loads of questions on Instagram, so thanks very much for those when I posted something about this Greg podcast. Really enjoyed those. Some exciting times actually for the podcast coming up. I've got a few of the biggest names of mountain bike racing coming on very soon, so cross country, downhill and enduro. I think hopefully the podcast is going to be, you know, banging the next few weeks. Don't forget you can listen to this on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer and all your favorite podcast providers. It should be on there. Thanks very much and catch you soon.